Mike Mullane and I had something in common. As boys, we both wanted to grow up and be astronauts. One of us accomplished that. Mike was selected in 1978 as a mission specialist in the very first group of space shuttle astronauts. He completed three space missions, logged 356 hours in space aboard the shuttles Discovery and Atlantis before he retired from NASA and the Air Force in 1990. He's been inducted into the International Space Hall of Fame, has gotten the Air Force Distinguished Flying Cross, the Legion of Merit, and the NASA Space Flight Medal, and now has written about the outrageous tales of being a space shuttle astronaut in a book just released this week called Riding Rockets. I'm happy to welcome astronaut Mike Mullane to the Paul Harris Show. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. What does mission specialist mean?
There are two NASA astronaut positions on a space shuttle. You have pilot astronauts and you have mission specialist astronauts. Pilot astronauts are obviously the ones who are sitting in the front seat, have the stick and throttle in their hand, would fly the vehicle. The mission specialist astronauts, and usually there's two. Well, there's always two pilots. Usually there's a minimum of three mission specialists. The three mission specialists are the ones responsible for whatever's going to go on the mission, operating the robot arm, doing spacewalks, doing experiments. They will specialize in those activities.
So you're not a scientist going up there doing scientific experiments. You're actually part of the mission crew.
Right. A mission specialist, basically pilots and mission specialists are systems operators. We're trained to operate the systems of the shuttle, operate somebody else's experiment, for example. Some university professor might have an experiment on a shuttle and we'll be told how to operate it. But we're not scientists. We have scientists, mission specialists, but even they are trained as systems operator.
Gotcha.
Payload specialists, the people who are really true scientists, they go up there with the crew. They will be taking their own experiment up there and be fiddling with that. They're the scientists, the payload specialists.
All right. I want to talk about your adventures in space, but before we get to that, I want to talk about some comments you make in the book about NASA and about the space shuttle program, which apparently is kind of in limbo, although I think they have another launch scheduled for May after Columbia and the problems they had last year. What's the status of NASA's shuttle program, and exactly what do you think should be going on?
Well, the shuttle, as you know, has been grounded since July or August when they launched Discovery and then saw the foam problem had not been fixed. And by the way, that shocked the dickens out of me. When NASA knows they have a problem and they throw hundreds of millions of dollars at it to fix it, they fix it. And I was just absolutely shocked to see that they hadn't fixed it. And I'm sure they were shocked, too, to see they hadn't fixed it and those videos of foam coming off the gas tank in that last launch. So the shuttle's been indefinitely grounded because of that. I hear whether we'll make a May launch. That probably isn't going to happen. It's probably going to be later than May. But sometime here in the next 6 months, we'll launch a shuttle and hopefully not see any repeat of the foam problems, and it'll be returned to service. Now, that service is going to be brief. The NASA administrator has come out and said that he wants to ground the shuttle as soon as possible. He only wants to fly the minimum number of missions to build the International Space Station and then ground the shuttle. He argued that it is a flawed vehicle, flawed, and that it does not have a bailout system for the crew, and that he also added human perfection is impossible to attain, so it's always going to be possible somebody's going to make a mistake and cause a catastrophe where the crew would need an escape system, but on the shuttle, they don't have one. So the shuttle is very dangerous in that regard, and he wants to, you know, fly the minimum number of missions and then ground it. And then from there, we will probably move on. It'll be back to the future. The astronauts will ride into space on a rocket booster with a capsule on top, with a tractor escape rocket on top of that capsule to provide crew protection in the event of a booster failure. It'll look very similar to the old Atlas and Saturn type of rockets.
You call the shuttle the most dangerous spacecraft humans have ever ridden.
That is true.
Is that because there's no way to escape?
Yes. All the rockets that have ever been built that we've put people on, the Redstones, the Atlases, Titans, Saturns, they were all very dangerous. They all are very complex, just like the space shuttle. The difference is that the earlier astronauts had crew escape systems so that if all this complexity failed and the booster failed, they had a way of bailing out. On the shuttle, you have no way of bailing out. during powered flight. If the rocket booster fails, as we saw on Challenger, there's no hope of escape. You cannot get out in those circumstances. That's what makes it the most dangerous spacecraft that has ever been, that anybody's ever ridden, this lack of a crew escape. But let me expand on that, too. People, if you look at the old capsule designs, you'll see a tower up on top of the capsule. That is a tractor escape rocket. And if Neil Armstrong's Saturn V had blown up, that tractor escape rocket would have fired, pulling the capsule away from the failing booster. A parachute would have been deployed, and they would have been lowered into the ocean. And the Russians, by the way, use a similar system. And two Russians have actually had their lives saved when this system, this tractor escape rocket, has functioned on their with their capsule and pulled it away to safety when their booster blew up on the launch pad over in Russia. So it works. And I think, looking back on it, that if the Challenger crew had had an escape system, they probably would be alive today.
What about the Columbia crew?
Columbia, a winged vehicle like the shuttle, I don't know how you could ever have provided an escape system. I shouldn't say ever. I mean, engineers are very clever, but you need some type of a capsule type of system that's going to save people from those in an area of maximum aerodynamic heating like the Columbia experience. I think it would be difficult, to go back and retrofit the shuttle with some type of an escape system that's going to protect people on reentry. Launch probably would be easier, although it'd even be a difficult task doing that.
You were a part of the first astronaut corps to include women and minorities. You had Sally Ride and Judy Resnick and Guy Bluford, who was the first African-American in space. The first Asian-American was part of that crew with you. Was that difficult for the men-only culture of NASA to accept, not the black guy and the Asian guy, but the women?
Yes, the military astronauts. I probably shouldn't speak for all of them, but certainly there were a lot of them similar to me in that women were alien creatures. Professional women working in the workplace with professional women was a new experience for most of us. Most of the military astronauts now. I tell people it was like stepping onto Mars. A good analogy there as far as how alien it was for us all of a sudden to find ourselves working professionally with women. And frankly, it didn't go down real well because we were all, well, I'll say it, we were male sexist pigs. We were, let me give my background as an example. I went to West Point. There were no females there. In fact, in the book, I say we, in West Point, cadets look at women like convicted felons doing 30 to life. And it's like being in prison there. And then went into the Air Force. There were no female flyers. Went to Vietnam. Of course, that was an all-male experience. And so it was age 32 when I stepped into NASA. Was the very first time in my life I ever had to incorporate professional women into my workplace. And I was a dinosaur, really, a male sexist pig. And I felt, when I walked in there initially, I really tended to view the women as misplaced, that, had serious doubts about them. Before people get interrupted on this and don't hear the end of the story, let me tell you, I was converted over the years. I came to respect deeply the capabilities of the females, and I developed very close bonds with a lot of them. Judy Resnick, Ray Seddon, Kathy Thornton. She was in a group downstream of us, but I came to respect them greatly. They were really true, top drawer type of people. But going back to when I stepped into day one, I will freely admit that I had my doubts about those women, and I think probably a lot of the military astronauts did because of our all testosterone background. And it took, I think, all of us eventually converted, but it just takes a while of seeing how competent and how professional and how brave, frankly, they are.
I couldn't help but notice that list of women didn't include Sally Ride.
Sally, all of the six females, I mentioned this in the book, all of the six females that I was selected with, and they were the first six females.
29 men, six women.
Right. All of those women were feminists in the sense that they were there to prove that they were as good as any man. Sally was the only one that struck me as an activist, that was trying to make a political statement in addition to a personal one. And given that I was this male sexist pig at the time, obviously, that was fire and water. So, I can't say that I had a deep bond with Sally, and I'm sure she would probably say the same about me, and probably would say the same about a number of military astronauts.
But you write in the book, particularly about Judy Resnick, who it seems to me like you got very close to because you worked so closely with her, that it was also incredibly hard on her, but she knew what she was getting into and understood that this was going to be part of her new life.
Well, there were women who handled us better, perhaps, than did Sally. Judy, certainly, and Ray Seddon, certainly. They had much wider tolerances on the what I call in the book our arrested development tendencies. I say the military males were from planet arrested development, and so those two women had a much greater tolerance for it. Ray Seddon certainly had to, because she married who gets in this Top Gun Navy pilot who was right there with Mike Mullane in attitudes in the early years. But Judy certainly came to, was much more tolerant. I don't know why, she was, and Ray was, and actually some of the other women too. But they gave us time to adjust our thinking.
Was it
like I said, Judy and I, we flew together on our first mission. She was subsequently killed on Challenger, and it was that exposure really with Judy that really drove home the point to me as how competent and professional and just good, just really good, these women were.
Was it tough on Guy Bluford, the first black astronaut?
No, I never ever saw the slightest indication there was any racist type of thoughts or attitudes at all. No, I just, I think it was my impression. I say it in the book that the office was colorblind. Wasn't gender blind, but it certainly was colorblind. I never saw any type of indication there was any issues there.
You mentioned the Challenger explosion. I want to talk to you about that and a lot of other things. The book is called Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. Mike Mullane is my guest here on the Paul Harris Show, and we're back in a moment on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with astronaut Mike Mullane. He's got a book out called Riding Rockets, stories about his life and times growing up and wanting to be an astronaut and finally getting there and logging 356 hours in space aboard the space shuttles Discovery and Atlantis. He was part of the first shuttle astronaut corps, and that meant that he had to live through the Challenger explosion in 1986, his colleagues dying on board the shuttle. And I'm guessing that the next time you had to go and get into space, your wife was absolutely freaked out.
Well, actually, Paul, I mean, the fear factor, I don't think changed much with the military people and their spouses with Challenger. I think, I know in my case, my wife and I had certainly experienced our share of loss in our military careers and buried friends and consoled widows. She knew how dangerous flying was, and I think that was true with most of the military spouses, or all of the military spouses. I think maybe some of the civilians and their spouses were a little naive about the risk they were taking pre-Challenger. But I would say for the Mullanes, the fear factor didn't really change that much. For the wife, probably a little bit, maybe a lot higher, but certainly I didn't want to give anybody the impression that pre-Challenger was just sitting there thinking that nothing go wrong. But for me personally, I was terrified on my first ride, which was before Challenger, and I was just as terrified on my second and third flights. The Challenger did not change anything with my fear factor.
Really? You're sitting there post-Challenger, waiting, you're hearing the countdown, you know what's going on, you've done this before, but still you don't have something in the back of your mind going, please let this work?
Oh, absolutely. I was terrified out there on the launch pad, and I document that in the book. But it didn't change. I mean, the first flight, I was terrified.
I see.
It was just, there was no change, from the first, which was before Challenger, my second and third, which were both after Challenger. I was terrified on all of them. Now, you're right about the families. Their fear factor probably went up significantly after Challenger. And in fact, a little insight here into what the families have to endure, and this occurs even before Challenger. The rules required, NASA's rules required the spouses and the children of the astronauts who are launching to watch the launch from the roof of the Launch Control Center about 3 miles away from the launch pad. And they weren't put there for the view. They were put there to isolate them from the press. In case disaster occurred, they want them completely isolated from the press. NASA would have complete control over them in that position. And about a month or 6 weeks or so before a launch, these spouses of the crew, they sit down together, and they pick two astronauts to serve as astronaut escorts, they call them. And these are astronaut escorts that are kind of to help, since their husbands or their astronaut spouses are going into the final month of training and they're living in the simulators. It's just a courtesy to have these astronauts to help keep the spouses up to speed on what's going on. But everybody knows what you're picking that spouse for. Those spouses are picking that, I'm getting my semantics picked up. The spouses are picking that escort for is to be with them in the event this rocket blows up. Mm. So they will be the first person, these astronaut escorts will be the first person that will be consoling them as newly made widows if that rocket blows up. Mm-hmm. My wife, when she was driving back from a party where the spouses of my first mission picked the astronaut escorts, she looked at me and she said, "This is a strange business when I have to sit down and pick an escort into widowhood." She knew exactly what the astronaut escort, that's a euphemism. Astronaut escort is a euphemism. What they are casualty assistance officers is what they are. So we called them in the Air Force, and they're going to be there to console these women if their husbands are lost in a launch. So it's incredibly stressful for the families. I was an escort into widowhood for a launch of some of my friends. I think it was like Flight 30 or so. And so I got to see firsthand on that roof what the spouses, in this case the spouses were the wives, what they were going through. And, I mean, one was shivering up there in the final seconds of the countdown. It is just absolutely terrifying for the families.
Mike, next week will mark 20 years since the Challenger explosion. Did we learn anything in the short term after that 1986 incident and in the long term in these two decades?
Well, I would argue that we didn't learn much from Challenger because basically the circumstances were repeated on Columbia. What happened with Challenger is that you have these O-rings, and they showed a long history of having problems. So that before Challenger occurred, these boosters come back, they parachute in the water, they're used over again. And on, I think it was 14 flights before Challenger, when they took the boosters apart, the used boosters apart, and inspected them, they found that fire was touching these O-rings, which was never, ever allowed. I mean, it was never intended, never expected. And it was a critical design violation to see that the O-rings were being damaged. But under tremendous pressure to keep the fleet flying, NASA basically accepted the fact that these were being damaged, rationalizing that, hey, the backup O-ring is holding, and they ran some experiments with damaged primary O-rings and said, it's going to hold pressure anyway. And so they got away with it basically 14 times, and they became comfortable getting away with it. And this is called normalization of deviance, where you just start cheating, and you get so comfortable doing it that after a while you forget how grossly you're violating a design standard. Well, the same thing was repeated, and of course, on Challenger, we eventually had two O-rings fail on Challenger, and the vehicle was lost, and seven astronauts died. Well, on Columbia, it wasn't the O-rings, it was the foam coming off the gas tank. We call the winged vehicle a glass rocket because of all the ceramic heat tiles and carbon panels that protect it on reentry. The design requirement is nothing can hit our glass rocket. No ice, nothing. So when they first saw the foam start shedding from the gas tank and hitting the orbiter, and they recorded that on Flight 1, by the way, and I think it was about another 60 times they actually documented that the orbiter had been hit by foam. And it didn't cause a catastrophe. It just scuffed a few tiles. Over time, it got accepted. People started seeing it as a maintenance issue. Between flights, they were going to have to change out a couple tiles that were damaged, scuffed. And eventually the team lost sight of how significant this deviance was, of having the orbiter being hit, and so we have another disaster that killed seven people, and that was normalization of deviance. So I would argue that not a lot was retained from Challenger since it was repeated on Columbia. I think NASA has it right now. I think everything I've read and everything the NASA administrator says sounds like NASA finally gets it when it comes to this vehicle, and I just don't think you're going to see a repeat of this normalization of deviance lesson that we've learned now twice.
How much responsibility do astronauts share with the bureaucrats at NASA and the engineers? I never hear anything about astronauts and their role in making sure that everything is safe for their own vehicles.
Okay, well, first of all, we didn't know anything about O-rings. A lot of people at Johnson Space Center didn't know anything about the O-ring problem. But like I say in the book, it wasn't O-rings that brought down Challenger. It was a failure of leadership. It was a cultural issue is what it was. There was a culture that permitted flight with a known design problem. And cultures are established over long, long periods of time by many, many, many people. You probably go back a decade and find people that, you know, if you traced it back, you could probably say, yeah, even people a decade earlier before Challenger were helping create this culture. So astronauts were part of the culture. I think what we were most guilty of was a mad thirst for flight. I think that we added to the culture in the sense that, gosh, you know, we can't ground this fleet. We got to keep flying. We were never confronted with that. I mean, nobody said, hey, we have burned O-rings. Do you want to keep flying? And, you know, we didn't have that decision to make. But the point is that in a lot of meetings I sat in on issues not related to the O-rings, the thing that we started to talk about is how is this issue going to impact the flight manifest? How many missions are going to be delayed if we do something? And so we were guilty of, I think, adding this our little part to this culture that resulted in the failure of Challenger.
Sounds to me like people kept their mouth shut so they could keep flying instead of asking tough questions.
Well, there was certainly a situation in the astronaut office where people were reluctant to speak up about issues that bothered them. One of the things people have to understand about astronauts is that we walk in to NASA paranoid. We know that there is, you know, for all of us, it's a dream. It's a lifetime dream come true. It's not a job. You know, we're there because it's in our DNA. We have to be there. We have to fly. It's a lifetime dream. And so we come into NASA terrified that we might say something, make a mistake somehow that's going to jeopardize our chance to fly in space. And that's the only place that you can fly into space is at NASA. Now, what I would fault NASA management for is they had to have recognized this, and they should have done everything possible to diffuse this fear. They should have been in the empowerment mode. They should have been standing in front of us, and I'm talking about Chief of the Astronauts, I'm talking Chief of Flight Crew Operations, the Center Director, the NASA Administrator, at multiple levels, and not just with astronauts, but with the entire team, projecting this statement, hey, my door is always open. I don't have all the answers. I value minority opinions. If you got a difference of opinion with me, I want to know about it. I don't want to hear what I'm doing right. I want to hear what I'm doing wrong or what I could do better. We never heard that type of empowerment. Nobody at NASA, I don't think, heard that type of empowerment from the leadership. Again, this goes back to the cultural failure or issues. And so that I really fault NASA leadership for is a lack of communication and a lack of empowerment. And so astronauts thrown in this situation were afraid to speak up on certain issues. We didn't know about O-rings, but I'll tell you, it really bothered us. We didn't have an escape system. Most astronauts, I think, felt the passenger program wasn't just crazy. It was immoral to be putting school teachers, politicians, foreign nationals, people on that rocket for public relations purposes. We thought that was crazy, but nobody was going to fall on their sword about those issues because we feared for our careers. Nobody was encouraging us to speak up, and in fact, you know, we would see situations with astronauts who, you know, there was no communication on how astronaut flights were selected. We didn't know how they were selected, but you would see some people flying multiple times before one person flew once. What did that one person do? What did they say? You had no idea, if anything. And there was just this vacuum of communication on the most important thing in our lives, that was flying in space, flight assignments, who makes them, who can veto them. And that put a significant fear factor in the astronaut office.
Former space shuttle astronaut Mike Mullane here on the Paul Harris Show. His book is called Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. We've got more coming up. Mike Mullane's memoir is called Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. He got to do that three times. three space missions as a mission specialist for NASA. On board the first one, Mike, is there a moment where you think, holy cow, I'm in space?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Actually, going back to before the launch, eventually the reality of what you're going to do, actually flying to space, finally catches up to you. Before, you know, when you become what I call prime crew, when the mission in front of you finally lands and you're next, that was the first time. Before that, you had so many distractions, you had so many doubts, you know, something could happen on the mission in front of you or missions in front of you and you would never fly. And I could easily push it back into fiction. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then all of a sudden you realize it is going to happen. And that thought would bolt me awake at night. I would just be absolutely jerked out of my sleep by the reality it's going to happen. The next person that flies into space, the next people that fly in space, it's going to include me. And I'd just be overwhelmed with this joy and fear. And when you finally get into space and you look out the window and you realize, you know, the last time you saw the Earth was from 200 feet high, and now you're looking at it from 200 miles high, 200 feet, you're on the gantry. You're now 200 miles high. It's just beyond belief. It's hard to believe that it's really happening. You're floating. All these things you've heard about, it's actually happening to you. And it is, joy beyond belief. It's a lifetime dream come true, and, of course, that's, everybody knows, is something incredibly joyful to experience.
Almost as good as hugging Christy Brinkley, huh?
Yes, I got to do that, too.
Yeah.
I got to hug Christy Brinkley, got to sit next to Bo Derek. I'm sure I met some famous men, but I don't remember them. By the way, it was meeting Christy Brinkley that broke up her marriage with Billy Joel.
I'm sure. Once she meets an astronaut, what does she need the piano man for? When you're on board the shuttle, you get sunrise every 90 minutes, right?
Right. Well, yes, sunrise every 90 minutes, sunset every 90 minutes. So every 45 minutes, you're either seeing a sunrise or a sunset.
Okay, so your first time up there, you're seeing this view that you just described. You know, not only are you now in space, but you can look out the window and there's the blackness of space. There's the blue Earth out there. How do you get any sleep?
You don't. At least I didn't, or very little. When I took my sleep restraint on our first sleep period and put it in the upper cockpit and slipped inside this thing, it's like a sleeping bag, basically, and put it underneath the overhead windows in the back cockpit. Since the shuttle flies in orbit upside down a lot, that meant that I had the planet in my face. And I had the attitude when I got up there, it says, I am going to spend the maximum amount of time looking out this window because I don't know if I'll ever again get to do this. And so what I'd do is I'd be watching out the window as the sun's up, and then eventually the sun would set, and I would nod off, and then the sun would come up again 45 minutes later, and I'd bolt awake and go, wow, and sit there looking out the window for another 45 minutes, and then the sun would set, I'd nod off a little bit more. It was very difficult.
I bet. I mean, you know you're only going to be up there for a little while. You want to absorb as much of it as possible.
Right. Now, I'm sure if you're up there on, like, an international space station for months and months and months, you're going to get good sleep habits. But on short shuttle missions, as I flew, I wasn't going to sleep. If I had any opportunity, I was going to be at that window.
Yeah, the book is a great read, and it starts off with a medical testing scene that, to me, sounds like it's right out of The Right Stuff. Which will you agree with me that that's the greatest movie about the space program ever made?
Well, until they make my book into a movie, right?
There you go. Have they sold the rights yet?
No. You're being facetious there, no.
But I would say The Right Stuff and maybe Apollo 13, the two movies that got it right.
I really liked The Right Stuff. I thought it was a great book. Really liked Apollo 13. They were superb books and superb movies that were made from those. So.
Until the Mike Mullane movie comes out, we'll have to live with those.
Yeah,
the book is called Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. I really enjoyed talking to you this afternoon. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Paul, there's one thing I should say is it's R-rated. I don't know if I said that other, but...
That's a good point. We should mention that.
It's not for children.
Yeah, don't... that's a very... especially starting right from the opening scene. That's absolutely true. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Astronaut Mike Mullane here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.